And it's 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Coming up next on People Rise Up, a conversation about nanotechnology. Listening to People Rise Up on KBOO, non-commercial community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, USA, and online at kboo.fm. My name is Andrew Geller, and we're going to revisit the issue of nanotechnology with a specific look at consumer products that already contain nanotechnology and efforts to have those more adequately addressed in terms of their health, safety, risk, and even just to have them labeled on the shelf to say that, yeah, there's nanoparticles here in this item you just purchased to possibly put on your body. My guest this morning is George Kimbrell. He is a staff attorney with the International Center for Technology Assessment back in Washington, and welcome to you to the program, George.
Hi, Andrew. Pleased to be with you.
Glad you could be here. Let's just start out for people who have not heard about nanotechnology. It's a fairly new industry. It's actually a whole wide range of industries. It crosses industries, and that's an interesting thing about this type of technology. Tell us what nanotechnology is and how it differentiates from kind of standard research and technological application.
Right. Well, nanotechnology is generally defined to mean the design or production of structures by controlling their shape or size at the nanometer scale, which is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter. For scale purposes, a human hair strand is 80,000 nanometers wide, or a red blood cell would be 7,000 nanometers. So we're talking about really tiny stuff, first of all. And the basic point to drive home, I think, is easily summed up as that while nano is a mathematical prefix that means 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, it's best understood to mean fundamentally different. And that's because at that particular range, the nanometer scale, properties take on fundamentally different, substances take on fundamentally different chemical and physical properties than they might have at larger sizes.
And I think that's a point that bears repeating, because that, as far as I'm aware, this is the only scenario where that's actually the case. I know that gold is often being used as an example because people are familiar, or carbon. So you have a lump of coal. It's a chunk of carbon. But when you break it down, I mean, to the point that you can even still see it, it's still carbon. And it will act the same as the lump of coal that fills your hand. But when you get down to the nanometer scale, the carbon molecules or atoms no longer behave in a way that the kind of larger bulk material does. And is there solid understanding of why that is, or is it just known that it is?
No, there definitely is solid understanding of some of the reasons why. The two main reasons, I guess, are first is that when you get down to the nanometer scale, a different realm of physics, quantum physics, comes into play, and those affect the different chemical and physical properties of the material. So you're not talking about Newtonian classical physics, which we understand and have a good basis for following. You're talking about a different realm of physics entirely. The second is that that reduction in size creates relatively an enormous surface-to-volume ratio increase, and the greater surface area of a nanomaterial increases its enhances its intrinsic toxicity. So a material, say, like aluminum that is stable in bulk form at the nanoscale is explosive, will explode.
Wow, interesting.
So basically the toxicity issue is one of the dangers that come out of the different chemical and physical properties of nanomaterials. They also kind of break down into two different types of risks, both to human health and the environment. The second one would be from these materials' seemingly unlimited mobility. As we mentioned before, they're very tiny. Because of that, unlike larger particles, they have this unique ability to move from one area of the body to another, be absorbed in organs and tissues, penetrate cells even. And those same mobility concerns would also come into play for environmental issues, interactions with ecosystems, the ability to persist and reach places larger particles could not, things of that nature.
There's a really extensive report that the Royal Society in England put out. I don't have a date on it, but it's sometime in the fairly recent past. And they have a large section all about the possible adverse health, environmental, and safety impacts. And it's from my kind of cursory reading of industry-related materials over time, it seems like there's a lot of talk about maybe not a lot, but there's an increasing level of talk about the need to study these impacts, but there really hasn't been a whole lot done in terms of that research yet.
Right. There is very limited health and safety and environmental impact research on nanomaterials, the funding for that needs to be significantly increased. Last year's federal budget, FY06 budget for research on nanotechnology issues was $1 billion. So there's no shortage of money being thrown at this stuff, but only a paucity 4% of that was given or earmarked for health and safety research. So there really needs to be a shift in that. But what we have seen, even amongst the limited amount of research that has been done, is a significant number of red flags, both for human health and the environment. The most recent one came out only last month. It was done by some EPA scientists at Research Triangle Park in North Carolina. And they found that low concentrations of titanium dioxide nanoparticles, which are in many personal care products and sunscreens, can produce free radicals in brain cells and potentially cause brain damage. So that's one of the more recent and scarier studies that I've seen, again, by EPA scientists, Environmental Protection Agency.
And we'll get to the issue of personal care products and a petition that you folks filed regarding those nanoparticle-containing sunscreens and other personal care products with the FDA in just a couple of minutes. But I want to reference back to this Royal Society report one more time. They look at the issue that you referenced earlier of mobility, and primarily mobility in air of nanoparticles. And they look at two different types of rock, that being quartz and then asbestos. And then the third thing they looked at was just sort of general small particulate air pollution, just urban air pollution, and even kind of natural air pollution from forest fire and volcanic eruptions. And it was really fascinating in that they said that nanomaterials, I mean, at the scale that we're talking here, they could basically be built to resemble, say, an asbestos fiber. And they have some interesting pictures of engineered, well, I guess it's not actually the nanomaterials. This is an asbestos fiber I'm looking at. But just that comparison sets off, I would imagine, in people's minds, you know, you start comparing something to asbestos or air pollution, and kind of an initial reaction would be, wow, I don't know if I really want to be messing around with that.
Definitely, Andrew. I completely agree. I mean, I think we've seen over the course of the last 100 years, you know, a number of quote-unquote wonder materials that have given us early warning signs of danger to human health and the environment, including asbestos, DDT, PCBs, to name a few. And I think that in this case, you know, the government regulators failing to take seriously these red flags suggests that they may have learned nothing from this long list of disasters. But there is a particular type of nanomaterial that does act and appear as an asbestos fiber, and that is a carbon nanotube, which is a engineered form of carbon on the nanoscale, which they are using now in manufacturing in several different industries.
Yeah, I believe I read that there are only 4 materials in production at a commercial scale at the moment. There is titanium dioxide, zinc oxide, I think there was an aluminum one, and I forget the other. It's not right in here in front of me. But there's not a whole lot of these being produced, but everything on the industry and even the government side, the National Nanotechnology Initiative folks, say, you know, within 10 years, this is just going to explode in terms of an industry. And we see the front edge of that now in that we can all go out and buy consumer products, maybe pants or glasses, or as you folks address most directly this summer, the issue of personal care products, sunscreens, lotions, etc. Why would a sunscreen or a lotion benefit from the use of nanotechnology?
Well, that's an excellent question, Andrew. Then I think the explanation helps explain nanotechnology's appeal to industry more generally as well, and why they're so different. Basically, a nano sunscreen, they're made with different nanomaterials, but most often titanium dioxide, nanoparticles of titanium dioxide or zinc oxide, as you mentioned. And those particular metal oxide substances, when engineered or manufactured to the nanoscale, have a fundamentally different physical property change that occurs. They become transparent. They become clear. So we've all seen the old bulk sunscreens, UV blockers from the 60s, like on the Gidget Show and things of that nature, where the lifeguards have the white underneath their eyes and on their nose, the white smudges. And that's because that substance in its bulk form appears white on skin. Well, when they found that it became cosmetically clear at the nanoscale, it becomes much more marketable to them for obvious aesthetic reasons. So they began to market it that way, and in fact patented these particles for their novelty. So these patented substances, which are fundamentally different, are now in these sunscreens, but the manufacturers and the regulating agency, which in this case is the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, are also simultaneously claiming that the substances are in no way different than their bulk material counterparts, which seems to fly in the face of their fact that they're using them at all.
Well, it's the exact same argument that the agricultural biotechnology industry uses by saying, oh, you know, this corn plant is exactly the same as corn plants have been throughout time, except that we've changed it and we can patent it because it's different. But it's the exact same thing, and you shouldn't worry about your health or your safety or the environmental impact from drifting pollen, because it's the same as it always was, except we own it, and you can't plant it unless you get our permission.
Exactly, and I think that my colleagues that have worked on biotech and genetic engineering issues for many years tell me this is deja vu all over again with nanotechnology for them. And I think that, you know, there is quite a big difference here. The red flags we've seen with the sunscreen specifically, and I do believe this is an urgent issue given that it is sunbathing season, and that parents and consumers are out there using heavy quantities of sunscreens right now, that these particular sunscreens be avoided. namely anything that has titanium dioxide or zinc oxide in it in its clear form. That's one way that you can avoid those, is to just buy them in their white smear form, their bulk form, and avoid the clear ones. But that some of the dangers would include, you know, what we've talked about previously, the production of free radicals that cause DNA damage to skin cells when exposed to UVA light, and eventually could cause cancer. So, in effect, people trying to avoid skin cancer could be harming themselves in the process by using these new substances unknowingly.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guest is George Kimbrell. He's a staff attorney with the International Center for Technology Assessment, and you can find out more about them online by going to www.icta.org. They have a bunch of information regarding nanotechnology and other technologies. You can also go to the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm for a link to them, more information about nanotechnology, and an online version of this program. So these sunscreens are out there. Apparently there's a couple dozen, I believe is what I read, different products. Maybe it's not all sunscreens. Maybe it's other cosmetics that are out there from a wide variety of manufacturers that people are now purchasing, putting on themselves, possibly their children. And you folks say, hey, wait a minute, we don't know about any of the potential health impacts, and you have sent the Food and Drug Administration a petition. Tell us about the petition process just in general, that you can launch a citizen's petition, and what you're asking the FDA to do.
Right. Well, back in May, after we had been working on this for quite a while, several years now, we filed, as you mentioned, a legal petition with the Food and Drug Administration on its regulation of nanomaterials in consumer products, specifically personal care products and sunscreens. And that's actually the first legal action filed in the U.S. to address the potential human health and environmental risks of nanotechnology. The way that the procedure works legally is that the agency now has to respond to our petition, and once they do, if we disagree with their substantive response, then we sue them in federal court over it. But basically, we've asked the agency sort of two different things. The first is an overarching regulatory scheme that would address the fundamental differences of nanomaterials. As of right now, their regulatory stance across the board for all consumer products containing nanomaterials, and as you mentioned, there's quite a few out there. The initial studies that we found that were put together by Friends of the Earth in conjunction with us, which in a report which was released in conjunction with our legal petition, found that there were several hundred consumer products on the market already, I believe 223, many of which are personal care products and sunscreens. At any rate, the legal petition, the first half of it focuses on, you know, overarching regulatory changes that would account for these differences, including new types of toxicity testing, which would account for their different chemical and physical properties, and mandatory labeling, as well as the addressing of environmental impacts under the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. The second half focuses specifically on sunscreens. As I mentioned, I think they represent a particular danger, urgent danger, because of their prevalence on the market and because they should be regulated by the agency as a drug instead of a cosmetic, which under which the agency is statutorily bound to hold them to a higher regulatory standard, a standard of more rigorous safety testing, which they have not done to this point. So the petition requests that the agency do so, and until that time, to recall the sunscreens from the market.
Now, I've read that folks are saying nanoparticles, nanomaterials, should actually be considered different chemicals. How does that idea dovetail with what you're asking for?
I think it's one of the underpinnings of our legal action. I think that, as I said earlier, you know, in a nutshell, nano means fundamentally different. That there is universal agreement among scientists internationally and here that these materials, you know, exhibit fundamentally different physical, biological, and chemical properties, properties that cannot be predicted from their bulk material counterparts. And we believe those properties demand new paradigms of testing, and that consumers should be aware of them through the labeling of the products, so they're not exposed unknowingly to these new substances and made to be guinea pigs by the agency and the manufacturers.
How does your effort with this petition at the FDA dovetail with more global efforts to look at this? Are you collaborating with any international organizations or organizations in foreign countries on this same type of effort, but at a global scale? Or are there efforts along those lines?
Definitely, Andrew. Our petition was filed in conjunction with a coalition of consumer health and environmental groups, including several international groups, Greenpeace International, Friends of the Earth, Australia, and the United States here. And I think that there are similar groups working in their respective home countries to make consumers more aware of these health and safety risks, and to have the regulators sort of catch up to the industry, as it were. The first product recall of a nanotechnology-laced product actually happened earlier this spring in Germany, where German regulators were forced to recall a product that caused 76 people to report respiratory problems and 6 people to be hospitalized. Later, that product was found to possibly not have nanotechnology in it, but because there are no standards for labeling or standards for regulatory oversight pre-market, before the product goes to market, there was no way of knowing at the time. So there are efforts internationally as well as here at home.
Okay, you bring up a question that I've been wondering about. Given that there's no labeling, I mean, I guess it's sort of similar to agricultural biotechnology. If there's no labeling, how is anyone supposed to know if anything's in there? And even further with nanotechnology, I mean, that's at a scale that's even smaller than genes, you know, as if we could see those. But, you know, it's like, how is it anyone's ever supposed to know if there's any nanoparticles around? How are they detectable?
Right, and that's a big concern. The studies that I've cited of the products that are currently on market are of self-identified products. In other words, those products that the manufacturers have identified as having nanotechnology or nanomaterials in them.
And they advertise that because of some perceived benefit or marketing.
Right, the high-tech hype, I guess.
Uh-huh. But
almost certainly that's an underestimate. Almost certainly there are many more products out there that are not labeled. And I think after our petition and hopefully more rigorous regulatory oversight, if we don't have some sort of a leadership coming out of the agencies, we may see other products sort of going under the radar, so to speak, with their nanotechnology and their products. But I do think that the first wave of consumer products containing these engineered nanoparticles have arrived, and they're, as you mentioned, just the crest of a wave of nanomaterial products spanning many technologies, which are coming soon, including food products, additives.
Yeah, I was about to go there. I saw reference of nanomaterials in food and drink, and I just thought, why? What's wrong with food and drink as it is? What could nanomaterials add to, you know, organically grown food, etc.?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not sure myself. I think that, you know, some of the appeal has to do with the antimicrobial and antibacterial properties that mm-hmm. some of these particles have. As I mentioned, they have, at the nanoscale, this exponentially enhanced toxicity. For example, nanosilver particles. Silver is naturally, even in its bulk form, antimicrobial substance. It kills bacteria. But when you engineer it to the nanoscale, that toxicity goes through the roof. So we're seeing quite a bit right now. Some of the first products are nano silver linings for refrigerators or for food containers for bacterial purposes. The problem is with these is that same property which makes the substance attractive to the manufacturer is highly toxic when it goes through the waste cycle and comes in out into the ecosystem. So you've got these silver particles at the nanoscale, which, by the way, we don't have any way of detecting yet to see where they go or how long they accumulate or, you know, where they accumulate in the environment, which are highly toxic to microorganisms. So it's a real issue there.
So we just got a couple minutes left here, and I'm curious if there's anything that listeners who are interested could actually do to have a positive impact on the outcome of your petition at the FDA, or is it really just the bureaucratic process and the interested parties and the regulators just kind of go through the motions, as it were?
No, there's definitely a place in the legal process for the public. That's one of the great things about our legal system here in the U.S. The way that any interested listeners out there and the public can play a role is to write in and comment publicly to the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, on our petition or on, you know, their concerns about the regulation by the agency of nanomaterials and consumer products. And they can find out information about that at www.fda.gov/nanotechnology. The FDA, in part in response to our petition, has scheduled its first public meeting on its regulation of nanomaterial products for mid-October 2006, this coming fall. We don't have a more precise date yet, but we should be getting one from the agency. And information about that public meeting will also be at that website address that I gave. The more that the public expresses its concern to the agency, both before and after that meeting, I think the better.
Okay, cool. And just out of curiosity, has anyone compiled sort of a definitive list where people can go and look online and see, like, brand names and types of products with confirmed nanoparticles the way that many non-governmental groups have done with genetically engineered foods?
Yes. There is the best report so far is the one I mentioned previously that came out in conjunction with our legal petition. It was done by Friends of the Earth. And it is available at their website as well as ours, www.foe.org or www.icta.org. It's called Small Risks or Small Ingredients, Big Risks, and that has an appendix at the end of it which lists, as I mentioned, several hundred consumer products, personal care products mostly, that contain nanomaterials. And it's all the big personal care manufacturers that we know, Revlon, Johnson & Johnson, L'Oreal. Also, the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars has a database also of consumer products. That's available at www.nanotechproject.org. Another good resource. Those are the best two out there right now.
All right, great. Thank you very much for listing those, and I'll put all those links up at the People Rise Up website as well. George Kimbrell is a staff attorney with the International Center for Technology Assessment. He's been joining us this morning to talk a little bit about a petition they filed with others to the FDA to look at the health and safety risks related to consumer products containing nanoparticles. Thank you very much for being on the program this morning, George.
My pleasure, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care. And again, icta.org, People Rise Up website, available at kboo.fm. Click on Public Affairs and then People Rise Up. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard today or any other day when this show ran, please send email to me at kboo@riseup.net. You can also send regular paper mail to me here at KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thanks very much for listening. In just a couple of moments, Jill Severson will be speaking with Gila Seversky of the Women's Coalition for Peace in Jerusalem and Palestinian-American activist and businessman Sam Bahour about current events in Palestine. Coming up at 11 on Democracy Now!, American Bar Association President Michael Greco will discuss a new report criticizing George W. Bush's unprecedented use of presidential signing statements, his abuse of presidential power, domestic surveillance, and torture. And Representatives Dennis Kucinich talks about his resolution calling on the Bush White House to appeal to all sides in the current Mideast crisis for an immediate cessation of violence. And at noon, in its brand new slot, returning to KBOO's airwaves, we have Alternative Radio by David Barsamian, featuring Stephen Kinzer today speaking on Iran, the 1953 American coup. Stay tuned to KBOO for Jill Severson speaking about current events in Palestine just after this.
Attention all KBOO members. There is an orientation for those of you considering running for election to the KBOO Board of Directors. The orientation is Saturday, July 29th, 10 a.m. to noon at KBOO. You will have the chance to chat with current board members about the responsibilities and opportunities that come with being on the Board of Directors, and also what kind of work is ahead for the board over the next year. That's an orientation for prospective board members, Saturday, July 29th, 10 a.m. to noon at KBOO. 20 Southeast 8th. See you there.
Yes, it's here. KBOO's 2006 Book and Record Drive, Saturday, August 26th at the Musicians Union Hall. KBOO is now accepting your generous donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs, and VHS tapes for this fun family occasion. Please bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in downtown Portland. KBOO also needs volunteers to help sort donations, bring them to storage, set up the day before, and, of course, during the event. If interested, please contact Ani Haynes at 503-231-8032 or email volunteer@kboo.org.
Fiend! Fiend! To love the cat is to be the cat.
This message is authentic and KBOO certified. Keep listening to KBOO 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM for more information.